You are listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. I'm Jeffrey Walker. Thank you for joining us on this Labor Day 2006. Coming up over the next half hour, WRIR News and Public Affairs will explore several labor issues around Richmond and the state. Coming up first, a roundtable discussion on local living wage and minimum wage campaigns. Later in the show, we'll hear from John Gregory, president of the Richmond Regional Labor Council, AFL-CIO.
Hello, my name is Denise Naim, and I'm joined by Kathy Woodson of the Virginia Organizing Project, Christina Rubiel, and Pat Lavelle of the Legal Aid Justice Center. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
We're here to talk about living wages and minimum wages campaigns that are going on in Virginia. Can you start out by describing the difference between the two?
Well, the minimum wage federally is the minimum amount that a person has to get paid. Under no circumstance a person can be paid under that. And since that is federal law, the states can't go under that. They can, however, pass laws to go pay a higher amount, and 23 states have. Right now, Virginia is the same as the federal wage, and we want to increase that amount. The minimum wage takes into consideration the real expenses that a family or a person has, including cost of school and all those other issues, and sets a minimum amount that a person needs to survive with minimum standards of dignity, and tries to implement them the way that's been, because it's a higher amount than the minimum wage, trying to do it locally through the government, people who do business with the government, and I think VCU has one, and so there's a local campaign. We're mostly involved in the campaign for the minimum wage, and that's where we have most of our information.
What's the main purpose of a minimum wage, and has it ever been enough to make ends meet?
The basic purpose is to ensure, as Christina said, that no one that is working, at least in the above-ground economy, is going to be paid less than that. Nobody believes today that the minimum wage is anywhere close enough to being actually what it takes to live on, but the idea is at least that the minimum wage provides sort of a benchmark that employers have to live by to prevent workers from being exploited by even lower wages.
Yeah, and most people today forget that minimum wage is $5.15 per hour, and that is starvation wages in today's economy. We have not had a raise in 10 years in the federal minimum wage. And if you just look at what normally happens in your own family budget, when you look at the cost that food, transportation, health care, if you're able to afford health care, and housing, there is $5.15 is just not enough working full time to make ends meet. $5.15 an hour equals to $10,712 a year. In 2003, there was 21% of Virginians getting paid low wages.
Wow.
Remember, they still have to take out the taxes because Social Security taxes are taken out. They may not pay income taxes because they make too little, but all the Social Security, Medicaid, that has to be taken out. So it's minus taxes.
Right.
So this is astounding. I think that didn't think the first time that she quoted the figure, because how can that be? A person working full-time making a little bit over $10,000 a year, that's ludicrous.
Whenever lawmakers talk about these wage increases, the argument often turns towards how it will hurt small businesses. What I wanted to ask you was if you could describe the effect that it does have on them and how you respond to the argument that it does affect them.
Well, the response we've given is that we know that between 1998 and 2004, the small businesses in states with minimum wage higher did not experience a loss. Actually, they experienced a growth. And so we have not found research that can substantiate that argument totally. Of course, you can always adjust the numbers to show whatever you want. And I know that in this past General Assembly, there was some concern about that small businesses would lose. The information we found from the Economic Policy Institute and Fiscal Policy Institute supports that businesses win.
And anecdotally, anecdotally, some people with small businesses who want to be fair to their workers and pay a decent wage, something that they're, you know, out of their personal moral obligations, they actually do worse because the businesses next door who don't care and who just are willing to exploit them, they can't and they can sell for less. So for that sense, it equalizes the playing field that everybody has to pay a certain decent minimum wage. It's what we were talking about before, the grapes of wrath syndrome, right? That people can bargain out their labor for lesser and lesser amounts. Right. So the minimum wage, even though it sets the amount that it can't go below, it's still too low. It gives plenty of grapes of wrath type of situations to happen. And that's not even to include the cases that Pat does where people are not paid their wages at all. A lot of these day laborers get stiff from their wages. And
the employers who are paying above the minimum wage, what they've experienced is they create a stable work environment for themselves. And so there's a commitment from their workers to stay with them. They have low turnover rates, which is very important in any business. So you get a commitment from your worker. Generally in the community, if the worker earns more, they have more money to spend and put back into the local economy, and it decreases their need to depend on social services.
Why would some people who've never had to work for a minimum wage be concerned about this?
I met a legislative aide last year in the process of lobbying for this, who had mentioned that he was himself working for a minimum wage a couple summers ago at a watermelon farm and didn't see a problem because he was the legislative aide now, and maybe soon enough, after a few years, he'd be a legislator and move on to something else. He didn't perceive the need for minimum wage because he saw that he could move on. I think with regard to your question about the interest of folks that don't have to work for minimum wage or low wages, I think it's important because folks need to realize that they're living in a community, and a community depends on, you know, the people that are serving them food at restaurants. It depends on people that are helping take out the trash, that are caring for members of their family, like home health care aides, that type of thing. And the community thrives or doesn't thrive depending on how it treats all of its citizens. I think another piece of that is simply that if we want to perpetuate the idea of a healthy community, of a community that values and respects work and has people actively engaged in work rather than, you know, being on the sidelines, then if we value work, then we have to reward work. And that's another thing that should get people that are not at the minimum wage interested in seeing in advance.
You know, I think we all have to think about the subsidies we're providing. If you are not a low-wage worker, you are still subsidizing a low-wage worker. If you are giving tax credits to corporations, you are subsidizing low-wage workers. If you are providing donations to large nonprofits that are serving low-wage workers, you are subsidizing low-wage workers. We also need to think about, again, how we are creating people's dependency on those social services.
It's interesting because, like, that example to me that the person, the legislative aide, that said, somebody who doesn't see that this is going to ever come to impact them. You know, they have family, they, you know, they got an education, whatever, they have influences. But I think that it does. Before I worked here, I worked at the legal aid in Compton, and it's very clear there what you see. These communities have the lowest education, and the kids come out, there's a high amount of people going, the social service coming in, taking the kids out of the home, and then the kids are left, run around in foster care, a lot of times sexually abused and whatever. They don't have a home to come back to, right? They split them up from the parents. So they're left, and what do? They start joining gangs. And if you're going to make $5.15 an hour, or you can sell drugs down the street, making a fortune, they don't have a high life expectancy. Why would they? This is how they feel. We have to put ourselves in the shoes of people, and we are, everything's interconnected. So if you don't think that this is going to affect you, it will, because these kids who are upset and who don't have an expectancy to have a decent life, people want more than just survive.
What are you gonna do, Joe, when the war is won? What are you gonna do when you lay down that gun? Can't have no depression all over again. G.I. Joe, the CIO, has got a plan. We've got
That was WRIR's Denise Naeem interviewing Kathy Woodson with the Virginia Organizing Project, Christina Rebell, and Pat LaBelle with the Legal Aid Justice Center. For more information, go to www.bafairwage.org. Coming up later in the show, WRIR's Aaron Stemsel interviews Delverna Russ and Ruth Strauss from Central State Hospital in Petersburg. Up next, the ideal labor candidate and this year's elections.
We've got a plan, Joe, we've got a plan. Jobs and security for every fighting man. You fight for us and we'll fight for you, and we'll all work together when the fighting's through.
This is Catherine Comp with WRIR LPFM News and Public Affairs. I'm speaking with John Gregory, president of the Richmond Regional Labor Council, AFL-CIO. Thanks for joining us for this Labor Day special, John Gregory.
Oh, glad to be here.
I understand that right now you've been putting a lot of resources into the November U.S. House and Senate elections. Can you talk a little bit about why this year's midterm elections are important for labor?
Sure. I'd be delighted to talk about that, actually. We're being dismantled. The middle class is being slowly dismantled. Everything that we spent our lives working for and expecting is being taken away from us. Social Security is being attacked. 40-hour work week has been attacked. The minimum wage, we can't get that raised, but they'll give themselves a raise. And they're rewarding their friends in ways that's never been done before, such as like Medicare Part D, you know, the new system where they're going to get some assistance for prescription drugs. Well, it's got a little clause in there that says the drug company sets the price and they're non-negotiable. What kind of business is that? That's just a blatant reward to the drug companies at taxpayers' expense. So these are just a few of the reasons why these elections are very important.
If you could create a perfect labor-friendly candidate, what would they look like and what types of issues would he or she be talking about?
Well, you know, first thing we got to say is that, you know, because you're pro-labor does not mean you're not pro-business. You know, we don't have jobs. We don't make money without jobs, and we need smart, educated people who are going to understand the system. For example, right off the top, economics, 101. Giving money away to the rich and tax breaks does not create jobs. It creates bank accounts. You know, you need to work on the infrastructure. And when you do that, you know, you'll see that the middle class will have jobs. Their children's going to have, a means to get an education. And that's another thing that the burden's being shifted on us to pay for is our children's education. And it perpetuates everything. You know, when you have a good job, you make a good living, you get to put some money away from your retirement, you know, you bring your children along in an environment that's conducive for a good education so that they can better themselves. So the perfect labor candidate's got to recognize the contributions that the working men and women make and don't take us for granted with their legislation that's being made. You know, we need somebody that's going to stand up for the rights, recognize that, you know, if the congressman can get $37,000 in raise, why in the world can't they raise the minimum wage for workers that are only making, what, $11,000, $12,000 a year? They've given themselves a raise that amounts to twice what the minimum wage earner makes in 1 year. That's just horrible. You know, I guess they think these people are supposed to be happy about that. You know, so you need a congressman that's going to, and a senator, who knows how to keep the economy going, because, you know, you have to have business, but you also have to have that balance of knowing who's the one that is making the business go, and that's the workers. So they need to be treated properly, and, you know, just with a little respect, a little dignity, decent wages, and... Sooner or later, they got to recognize how important health care is.
Over the past decade or maybe a little bit longer, the influence of big business on elections has become more prominent with bigger and bigger campaign donations. I'm wondering how a candidate can commit to all the things you just talked about when they're constantly being pressured by money from industry and corporations.
That's what makes it tough. That's why it's hard to find that good candidate. You know, we're not pro-Republican, pro-Democrat. We're pro-labor. You know, unfortunately, there's one party that absolutely despises organized labor and basically working men and women. But that doesn't mean that the other party is automatically going to get our endorsement. They've got to answer questionnaires, you know, and go through, jump through some small hoops, you know, I guess you'd have to say, to make sure that they mean what they say. You know, we'd like to sit down and talk to them face to face. And, you know, you judge a lot about a person by looking at their eyes when they're answering your questions.
Well, let's talk about some of these specific races. Many people will be closely watching Virginia's Senate race between incumbent Republican George Allen, Democratic challenger Jim Webb, and there's an independent Green candidate, Gail Parker. What have these candidates promised so far in terms of improving conditions for workers?
Well, you know, I really didn't know much about Jim Webb. Coming from his background, you know, I was quite surprised at how impressed I was with him. He's a pretty stand-up, stalwart individual, and, you know, his position is pretty much, you know, what I was just talking about and alluding to earlier about the fact that, you know, he's wanting to create the jobs, invest in the infrastructure, and understands the basic economics that, you know, this trickle-down, giving the money to the top doesn't work, and the fact that the real thing I was happy to hear from him was his understanding of the fact that by cutting the taxes, they're actually taxing our children. You know, the debt now is astronomical. You know, last number I heard was, you know, every man, woman, and child, $7,000 was their part of the debt. And when you're cutting these taxes, the money's going to the top. The majority of these tax cuts are going to the rich. And that's putting a burden on us, middle class and lower class, to pay that debt.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the congressional candidates that have been particularly outspoken on labor issues?
Well, we've got you know, a few friends here in Central Virginia. We've got one that's been there for years, and that's Congressman Bobby Scott. He's quite a stand-up guy. He's very much a working man's congressman. You know, he believes in the people, and it shows in his voting record and the things that he stands for. And we've got another candidate in the 7th Congressional District this year, Jim Nachman, who's running against Eric Cantor. He struck me as somebody that was very in tune with the issues. He seemed to have a real feel for how to fix the things that are wrong. You know, and that's something a lot of people can't do. You know, it's real easy to sit back and point a finger and lay blame, but it's really nice when you hear somebody that has solutions or has ideas about how to fix it. You know what I mean? It's easy to lay blame, but it's the old saying, it's easy to be against something, but it's hard to be for something.
Now, this is a midterm election, which generally doesn't bring out as many voters. Has the Richmond Regional Labor Council been doing any get-out-the-vote campaigns?
Well, we always do a voter registration drive. You know, we push for that at the end of the summer and starting into September every year. And we, you know, try to talk to all the local unions to get them to get letters out to their membership, to get out to vote, let them know who the labor-endorsed candidates are and why we like them. You know, we don't tell people how to vote. We try to give them the information that we have and let them see that, you know, hey, this is the right person for us. Of course, you know, we always have, but we'll do, you know, the mailings and phone calls and phone banks, depending on how intense the races get. You know, we'll get out there and do whatever we can, you know, try to put our resources into the areas where it's going to do us the most good, because quite frankly, you know, we're just poor old working people struggling to make a living. We have to be careful about where we spend our money.
If anyone should ask you who composed this song, tell them 'twas the CIO, 6 million strong. And we're working people, need us, that's where we stand. G.I. Joe, the CIO, has got a plan.
And that was WRIR's Catherine Crump interviewing John Gregory, president of the Richmond Regional Labor Council, AFL-CIO. Coming up next, nurses fight harsh working conditions at Central State Hospital.
I'm here with Delverna Ross and Ruth Strauss from Central State Hospital. Ruth, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Ruth Strauss, and I'm a nurse. I've been in nursing straight 64 years. Right now, they have me out on suspension because I refuse to do 16 hours. It's impossible after 8 hours to do another 8 hours and be alert. It's a big safety issue. And my first oath that I took when I graduated was to do no harm. And if I'm not alert through the second 8 hours and my energy is gone, this patients, this other staff, and myself, we're all at danger, and I refuse to do it. So as an example, I'm out for 10 days without pay.
So they're trying to make an example of you.
And I'm being made an example of right now.
So what is the biggest problem facing the nurses at Central State Hospital?
Mandatory overtime.
Mandatory overtime? Could you describe what exactly?
Perfect example. Last night, I worked from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till 11:30. Then we get, of course, the wards are usually short because people work a lot of overtime. So I was mandated to work another 8 hours, and that's what we call back-to-back. I got off at 7:30 this morning. I went home, showered, and I'm here right now. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's sometimes we work three days. Well, I say two. We'll come back to work, and then we'll have to do another 16 hours. And it's really strenuous and stressful because I don't live in Petersburg. I live in Henrico County. Mm-hmm. We've also addressed the question of, this is a huge hospital. And for people who, we've already lost two people due to accidents. One person lost her life because of mandatory overtime. We're exhausted.
I work with a nurse directly who was recently going home, fell asleep driving after 16 hours and mm-hmm. ran into the back of a man. And they were both shaken up. Also, there have been several medication errors, which is covered up because the wrong medicines have been given just through
this is because
being tired
the fatigue
and,
yes.
and
mandatory
exhausted.
Overtime.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And that's why it's very unsafe.
Why do you think they are requiring people to do mandatory overtime?
Well, when I first went to work there, it was emergency mandatory. Ms. Parham, the director of nurses, has made a new policy. It's not well known. It came up on the internet. And she is going to use mandatory overtime to staff the hospital.
That sounds pretty dangerous, don't you think?
It's very dangerous. Very, very dangerous.
We are working with criminals. Everything that you see on the news, practically everything, every person that commits a heinous crime, they come to our hospital most of the time for evaluations. Mm-hmm. They have to get them under medication. Some of them are really psychotic. And the hospital is predominant. A lot of the employees are women who work with these people hands-on, one-to-one. Mm-hmm. It's a big safety issue, and even sometimes after 12 o'clock, your security staff leaves, so that leaves women to handle all the responses, mm-hmm. because at any time a patient could just lose it or just flip out, so to say. It's just a very dangerous situation, and a lot of people have been hurt, but a lot of people have to come back to work because they have to feed their families. And we're also living under the threat, what I perceive is people think that if they don't obey these rules that they'll lose their job. We have laws on the books that protect us from that, but when people have been so intimidated, there's no getting through to them. It's like pulling teeth. I'm working really hard trying to band them together. It's not to fight against management, but it is to make them give us dignity, respect, and the safe environment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot of small issues that could be resolved if we could just get together and discuss this. But they always digress from the issues that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and before you know it, it's time for them to go, and nothing has been resolved. And that's more frustrating than anything to people who are doing this kind of work.
We're talking about working conditions at Central State Hospital in Petersburg, Virginia, about an hour south of here. You were saying that you're not fighting against management, but you're fighting to provide workers with dignity. And so this is why you've become involved with United Electrical Workers.
Absolutely. If I may digress a moment.
Sure.
I'm not a Virginian. I'm here by other circumstances. But my family, my whole life has been involved in unions. And being a New Yorker, you got the Transit Authority, you have sanitation, mm-hmm. you have the police department, and you know, if we can't get what we want, we will go out on strike. Doctors, nurses, everybody, and we shut the city down if they don't want to come to the bargaining table. We shut it down and we get what we want. We don't want to do that because I was in a medical hospital in the city. So, you know, we have people coming in ambulances, people in critical care and all that. The minimum staff is left there to care for them, but you have to show administration that you have the right to live in a decent workforce for decent pay and to be safe and take care of your patients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be able to live on the wages that they give you.
Ruth Strauss and Delverna Ross are hospital workers at Central State Hospital that have joined the United Electrical Workers, Local 160, a union focused on organizing state workers in Virginia. Mr. Ford, as a union representative, could you share some info on its current projects?
We're working on projects of trying to establish the organization with more state workers in different facilities. There are several facilities that we do have members. Western State Hospital, where we have no meeting room. Piedmont Geriatric, where we can meet, but it's outside in the parking lot. Southside Virginia Training Center, we can't even get in the parking lots there. We have to hand out our leaflets at the roadside. Central State Hospital, same, only at the roadside. And Hiram Davis. There is one place we're able to have meeting rooms, and that's at Eastern State Hospital, where Mr. Favre is the director there. Thank goodness for him. He has the fortitude to allow them, the employees, to have meeting rooms at will, just about, at his facility. You know, other directors, I don't think, are opposed to that. I think some of the higher-ups in the administrative areas, like Ms. Wade, Deeds, and Gunther, are, you know, stifling the organization, or trying to stifle organized labor for the state employees.
This interview originally aired on August 15, 2006 on Richmond Indy Media News. This program airs every Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. and is produced by the Richmond Indy Media Center, providing grassroots news coverage in the Richmond area since 2001. Visit our website at richmond.indymedia.org.
You can also visit WRIR.org for more information on our regularly scheduled news and public affairs programming.
Boss comes up to me with a $5 bill, says, "Get you some whiskey, boy, and drink your fill.
Get thee behind me, Satan. Travel on down the line. I am a union man, gonna leave you behind."
I'm Jeffrey Walker. Glad you were able to join us for our special Labor Day programming. And remember this quote from economist and philosopher Adam Smith. Labor was the first price, the original purchase money that was paid for all things. It was not by gold or by silver, but by labor that all wealth of the world was originally purchased.
Thank you. On the 4th of July, the politicians say, vote for us and we'll raise your pay.
Get thee behind me, Satan. Travel on down the line. I am a union man, gonna leave you behind.
Then the company union sent out a call. They said, join us in the summer. We'll forget you in the fall.
Get thee behind me, Satan. Travel on down the line. I am a union man. Gonna leave you behind.
If anyone should ask you, your union, to sell, just tell him where to go, send him back to hell.
Get thee behind me, Satan, travel on down the line. I am a union man, gonna leave you behind.